from WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence. I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. It wasn't so long ago in America that a dog was man's best friend, yes, but ultimately just a dog. The family pet, it barked, ran free through the neighborhood, snuffed table scraps from the dinner table, and slept. Then, says our guest tonight, novelist, journalist, and social observer John Katz, came the 24/7 economy, disconnected families, divorce rates, and smaller social networks, and Americans began to turn to their dogs to fill in the emotional gaps, ease their anxieties, and serve as family members, even human surrogates. Historically, dogs have always worked in harness, in fields, at borders. But over the last 20 years, Katz writes, the work of dogs has become the emotional support of millions of Americans, and it may be more than dogs or humans can handle. John Katz made a name for himself writing about media and technology, about geeks and boomers and American suburbia. But for the last few years, Katz has turned exclusively to the subject of dogs. In his latest book, The New Work of Dogs, Katz looks at the complex relationships of 12 dogs and their owners in his hometown, Montclair, New Jersey, a town he calls Dogsville, USA, to explore the relationship of dogs and 21st century Americans. Do you buy it? Do you depend on a dog for emotional sustenance more than your parents did? Is America's emotional life going to the dogs? You can get involved in the conversation online. Go to our website, onpointradio.org, and click on Forums. Joining me now from Newark, New Jersey, is John Katz, author of The New Work of Dogs, Tending to Life, Love, and Family, along with two of his border collies, Orson and Homer, in the studio there, I'm told. Welcome, John Katz and company.
Thank you very much, Tom. That crunching you hear is the chewing on their dental rawhide treats.
Very good. I hope they're the very highest quality.
Chloroform, very high quality.
Very high quality.
Nothing but the best.
John Katz, you have written about so many aspects of American life. I mean, technology, media, geeks, the suburbs, boomers, and a lot more. What has brought you around to this riveted focus on canines?
Well, I'm a dog lover, and the dog lover's evil friend is, of course, the Internet, where a lot of us spend our time trawling around looking at dogs we have no business looking at.
Dogs to admire, dogs to buy,
dogs to look at, dogs in trouble, dogs to be rescued, dogs just of different kinds of breeds. And I had two labs, yellow labs, which were wonderful dogs, were my writing companions. They had about my energy level, which is to say that when the computer went on, they sort of went down and went to sleep and stayed there until it went off. And someone I'd become friendly with as a breeder of border collies, had a border collie in big trouble in Texas. The dog had become an obedience show dog and was mistreated. No one who knows him is surprised he didn't make it as an obedience dog, and was confined for some time in a crate and ended up being shipped to Newark Airport because she had read one of my earlier books and was convinced, as she put it, that our lifestyles meshed and we would connect with each other. And
this was the dog for you.
This was the dog for me, and my wife calls him Satan's Spawn.
Forgive me, but it sounds like the mail-order bride business.
It was a little bit like that. The dog people know that there, in most families, there's this dichotomy where there's the dog lover and the sane person. Mm. And the dog lover is always looking for another dog, and the sane person always has many good reasons why they shouldn't have one. But my first exposure to this dog, and this became my first dog book, A Dog Year, was when I got him home, he jumped on top of a minivan and rode it down the block while I chased him with a pooper scooper, yelling at him to get off.
I'm sorry, a border collie standing on top of a minivan?
He jumped on top of a passing minivan. Okay. And this is the moment I knew I was in a lot of trouble. I was in over my head. And it also began this extraordinary journey for me, a year that began with two yellow labs, ended with two border collies, a lot of dog training, a lot of sheep herding, a lot of broken windows, a lot of damage in the neighborhood.
And a lot of exposure, ultimately, to how Americans interact with their dogs. You write here, John Katz, that there are now 68 million dogs in the United States, a number that just astounded me, and far, far higher than it was only a few years ago. And you say that their role, their function, their work, as you put it, is into some terrain where it's not exactly ever been before. What's going on?
It's going through an extraordinary evolutionary change for dogs and for people. In 1960, there were 15 million owned dogs. Now there are 68 million plus 10 million in shelters. And in the last 20 or 30 years, you know, some of us may remember when we got a dog, we just went to the shelter and got a dog. Mm-hmm. Now people rescue a dog, or they go to a breeder and they choose a breed. The dog is given a human name. It's seen as a member of the family. It sleeps in bed. It's part of a $32 billion industry of food and treats and healthcare. And more interesting to me, what I saw somewhat in my own life, but also in the people I began coming in contact to, where people were telling me again and again and again that their dogs were providing them more emotional support than many humans in their lives. And for Newark of Dogs, I ended up spending a year with 12 people in different stages of lives and their dogs to take a look at that. Now, I have to say, I worked in conjunction with the University of Kentucky with some psychiatrists there who study the human-animal bond and attachment theory. And they got in touch with me after a dog year, and they said, look, you've done an attachment therapy of sorts with this dog, and it's very much an attachment theory issue that you've experienced with this dog. And that's what sort of started me on this path. I found the book to be amazing, really, much more wrenching, interesting, funny, complicated, and painful than I thought. I saw people telling me all year that their dogs meant the world to them. They see their dogs, some of them said, as children with fur. And it left me amazed, awed at the work dogs are doing for people and also somewhat uneasy about the implications of this for humans and for dogs.
John Katz, sort out for us here exactly what's new. I mean, dogs have been known for quite a while as man's best friend. You know, you can go back in literature and in our own lives. I mean, certainly in my childhood, my parents' childhood, my grandparents talk about beloved dogs. You know, I've had dogs in my life all my life, and they've always been important. I wouldn't have been embarrassed to say they were even emotionally important.
Oh, absolutely.
So what exactly is new here?
Well, dogs go back. History of dogs' attachments to human goes back about 20,000 years. A couple of years ago, they actually found a coffin in Israel that had a child with a puppy in it. And the work of dogs was really pretty utilitarian. Although people often loved their dogs, the dogs protected them or dogs helped them gather food. In recent years, of course, there are lots of beloved stories about family pets who people were very attached to. Everybody has a memory of dogs that marked periods of their lives, of childhood and other transitions. Around the time that I became very interested in why the numbers of dogs had exploded so much from the 60s on. Mm-hmm. And I found in my own research that it correlated almost precisely with the rise of television, with the rise in divorce rates, with the decline of the extended family, with the decline of open spaces where Americans could gather and meet one another, with rise in insecurity in the workplace, layoffs, mergers, acquisitions, instability in work, and in a general sense of disconnectedness also with civic alienation. You know, the Harris survey has done a poll of American attitudes towards civics ever since the early 60s. Americans feel disconnected. They feel powerless. They feel nobody's listening to them. So when you add to all these family issues, more people living alone because of health care, more people having emotional difficulties, you see the number of dogs and cats, too, rises almost precisely in correlation to that.
So why wouldn't someone come in and say, well, this looks like a pretty good thing if people are more disconnected, if they're lonely, if they're adrift? It's the kind of thing that one friend would say to another, hey, you ought to get a dog.
Well, it's often a wonderful thing. I think it's been a wonderful thing for me. It's been a wonderful thing for many, many of the people that I saw. What is really new and I think is accelerating is the view of dogs as increasingly human-like, as having human-like emotions. You hear people all the time talking about what their dogs are thinking. Their dogs are spiteful. Their dogs are jealous. Things that really are not dog emotions, but human emotions projected on dogs. The attachment theorists also taught me that people often replay attachment issues in their own lives in terms of trust and neediness and affection and loneliness on their animals. So it becomes a training issue, really. Overfeeding is a problem because people can't bear to deprive their dogs of food.
John Katz, I want to get a little sense of how this plays out in some of the stories that you saw in your book. There's a story of Donna here. There's a bit on page 129. I wonder if you might read and set up for us before you do.
Sure. Donna was one of the more wrenching stories I encountered in that year. She was dying of cancer. The cancer had spread to much of her body. She was disfigured and undergoing massive chemotherapy. And her husband couldn't handle it, really. They both agreed it was probably best for him to leave, and he did. And she chose to end her life with a corgi named Harry, who was a remarkable dog. And I spent quite a bit of time, some days every week, with the two of them. And I would often talk to her about this and say, you know, Donna, it's wonderful that this dog is – you can't look at this dog without smiling. He's a great dog. Yet I feel a little bit uneasy that you've chosen to end your life with a dog rather than a person.
Let's hear it.
Talk quite a bit about that. And I'll read you the little, mm-hmm. a little bit of that mm-hmm. discussion mm-hmm. from the book. "He means the world to me," Donna told me one day in the park. "It's hard for even my closest friends to talk to me about this. And my husband just cracked. Harry is my heart. He makes me smile, keeps me company, gets me off my butt." In interview after interview, I was struck by how often people refer to their dog as their heart. In certain contexts and situations, dogs are able to connect with the deepest part of a person, with someone's heart and soul, and that was what had happened here. Donna was a strong, good-hearted, resourceful, and inherently optimistic person. She never once complained about her illness or expressed bitterness at the humans who had fled when troubles beset her. She relied on a dog to ward off loneliness, provide activity and comfort. But was this a good thing? Stories about dogs like Harry are always related with warmth and wonder, but I was sometimes haunted by the idea that Donna should have had more people caring for her, not just a devoted corgi. Harry couldn't talk to her about her illness or her death the way friends or relatives would. In a different kind of society, or even this one 50 years ago, surely she would have been surrounded by her extended family, the members of a church, friends, neighbors, or perhaps a husband who wouldn't turn away. But in the absence of such rootedness, in the absence of community, I hated to think of her without that big-eared corgi. He was doing a hell of a job. "It's a simple relationship," she said. "What he does is make me feel loved, and what he also does is keep me concentrating on loving back," she explained one night. "I need that. I don't think dogs are a replacement for people, yet sometimes they are, aren't they?"
John Katz reading from his new book, The New Work of Dogs. So here's Donna. She's got cancer. Her husband's not there. She doesn't have extended family. Her corgi, Harry, keeps her company, makes her happy. What's the problem, John Katz?
Well, the problem is the dog was doing, every time she looked at the dog, she would smile. He was very, very faithful to her. I ended up thinking to myself, should there have been a person there? I guess it was a question more than a statement. It just bothered me. I felt uneasy about it. I couldn't feel quite comfortable that Donna was spending her last days alone with a dog.
You mean nothing but a dog to go out with?
I think I looked around there, you know, you could see these elements of disconnectedness, the lack of a family, the lack of a community around her, the lack of people who were willing to be with her during this very difficult time.
So there's a social problem. You say it's also in some sense a problem for the dogs.
Well, I think it's a problem for the dogs in that more and more as people draw the dogs more intensely into the center of their emotional lives, they're beginning to forget a bit that they're dogs. They're seeing them as little people. They're treating them as little people. And they're attributing all sorts of people-like emotions to them. This, I think, is making it sometimes difficult for dogs to live in the world. You know, only about 3 to 5% of dogs in America are trained at all. So there's a lot of evidence. You know, 400,000 children were bitten last year, seriously enough to require hospital treatment. You see dogs getting neurotic, getting anxious, chewing up the house because they're not trained. And I think also because a lot of pressure is being put on them. Now, in many cases, there's a duality here. You know, I think it'll be hundreds of years before anyone, certainly me, can say this is really a good thing, this is really a bad thing. I had this persistent sense of unease that what I was seeing were people projecting things onto dogs that dogs couldn't really do. There wasn't always a truth to the perception. And also a concern that more and more, as we're losing sight of the fact that these are really simple, relatively primitive animals, where dogs are almost being asked to live the lives of humans, which is really quite stressful and difficult for them.
Tough work for dogs. So are you standing back and saying, wow, this is pathetic? I mean, this was supposed to be the animal that made everybody feel good.
I sometimes thought, wow, this is wonderful. You know, there were some really happy stories. There's Tom and Penny, an elderly man who had a grumpy old dog just like him. And the dog really made it possible for him to live alone. I certainly saw some people having great joy from their dogs. They were comforted in loneliness. They did get an ease from solitude. But I'm not sure that it's entirely a good thing that dogs are doing the work of humans in that way.
John Katz, stand by. We've got to take a short break. We're talking tonight about the new work of dogs with writer, dog lover, and keen social observer John Katz. Do you depend on your dog for emotional sustenance more than your parents did? Are America's asking for something new from dogs today, something reasonable or something ridiculous? Are we asking too much of dogs? We're not taking any calls this hour, but you can get involved in the conversation online. Go to our website, onpointradio.org, and click on Forums. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the new work of dogs with writer, dog lover, and keen social observer John Katz. His new book is The New Work of Dogs, Tending to Life, Love, and Family. It says divorce rates are up, extended families are flying apart, and Americans are turning to dogs maybe for more than dogs can deliver. What's your relationship with your dog? Is your dog important to your emotional health? Is that a problem, or is that as it should be? And are Americans reading more into dogs than will ever be there? John Katz, you described that you got tied up with the University of Kentucky and the work of their, what, psychology department there on attachment?
Psychiatry.
What was the link that they're making?
Well, attachment theory is, you know, to some extent replaced Freudian theory as a cornerstone of modern therapy. It really looks at the way children early in life attach to their parents and the impact that has on relationships in terms of trust and openness and engagement with the world and optimism and a lot of other factors. It's very important. It shows up all the time in people's relationships with animals. I got to the point, I have to say, hanging around with dog people a year where I could look at somebody and their dog and sort of tell them what their mother and father were like.
Give us an example. How would you do that?
Well, you could see someone who would really tap into the dog as being very, very needy. Couldn't bear to train a dog, can't bear to correct a dog. That's an attachment issue.
So you imagine that their own parents treated them in that way?
Well, it works in a number of ways. You can overgeneralize about it, but it can be either people replicating the way they were raised or trying to alter the reality of the way they were raised or working out a trauma. You know, there's a lot of therapists actually study, rescue compulsion disorder, they call it, where people sometimes who hoard dogs or rescue them again and again and again are acting out early traumas in their lives. Nothing wrong with that. They're doing wonderful work. But I think there's sort of a ghost in the kennel sometimes. You know, there's us and there's our relationship with the dog, and then there's our own relationship in life that we bring to the dog. Trainers will tell you that dogs sort of know what they want to do. It's the people they have to train. And we're in this sort of odd situation. There's more dogs than ever, and everything that dogs really like to do, which is roll in disgusting stuff and have sex and squabble with each other, is either illegal or frowned upon. So we're really not letting dogs live the lives of dogs. More and more, in some cases, certainly not all cases, we're asking them to live the lives of the people we want to have around us. I can't tell you, Tom, how many people... and I have to say it was more women than men, but it was some men. How many people told me in the course of this year they got more emotional support from dogs than they got from the people they live with? And that it's great that they're getting the support, but it always left me a little bit uneasy. It's a strange commentary on life in America.
Dog lovers, what do you think? Do you hear yourself being described here? Do you have an unhealthy codependency or just dependency with your dog? We love those critters, but what about it? Jim is calling from Cambridge, Massachusetts. Hi, Jim. You're on the air.
Hi. How are you?
Great. Thanks.
Good. I love the fact that the topic's coming out. I think it's, I guess, the existence of a thing is dependent upon whether it exists or whether we're aware that it exists.
Oh, the thing being, Jim?
In this case, I think the topic is the relationship with dogs. And how dependent we are on them or how dependent we're making them on us. I mean, what basically you're talking about, I think, has been there for a very long time. I just think that we're becoming more aware of it. I don't think it's a new phenomenon as much as it is being a recognized phenomenon.
What's your relationship with dogs, Jim?
I'm a veterinarian.
Oh, so you give them shots.
I'm sorry?
So you give them shots. I mean, does that make you a dog lover?
I do give them shots. It's kind of like saying you talk as far as being an
officer. Okay, forgive me.
There's a lot more to it than giving them shots, and I actually appreciate the fact that through veterinary medicine I've learned much more about dogs than I think I ever would have known in any other way. I love the job that I do more now than I did when I started, and I didn't become a veterinarian for love of animals. I did it for other reasons.
So how do you see the relationship between dog owners and their dogs changing over your, some years as a veterinarian, Jim?
I don't see much change. I see our recognition of it changing. I see what the book is coming out is a popular book because we're becoming more aware of something that's been there all along. 20 years ago, I had little old ladies who would come in and say, "You can't let my dachshund die. My husband died last year. It's all I have." 20 years ago, I had that. Now I have that. I have the same thing now. But what I think is we're, as a culture, we're evolving into becoming more aware of this relationship, and we're accepting it more openly.
Jim, we've got it, and I thank you for the veterinarian's view there. John Katz, this brings back up the same sort of initial question, is whether this is really something going on to a new degree or a new intensity, or as our veterinarian Jim would have it, this just is something that's being acknowledged, and at that point hasn't always been acknowledged. I mean, we call them man's best friend.
Well, there's a lot that's new. You know, I spent during the book a week at a vet's office, several vet's offices in my town. I saw in one vet's office there were four dogs on respirators with terminal cancer because their owners couldn't bear to let them go. I heard women say in the vet's office, I don't care what happens to my husband. You've got to keep this dog alive. I can't live without him. And the vet was telling me all the time, you're going to hear people say that all day, which I did. Here's what else is new. 86% of dog owners refer to themselves as mommy or daddy when they talk about their dogs.
86%?
86%. 59% of people who own dogs say they speak to their dogs at least once a month about issues, important issues involving their lives. An enormous percentage, I don't have a specific, but I heard people say it all the time, seeing their dogs as members of their families, as children with fur. They give them human names, of course, which is relatively new. It isn't that that being attached to a dog is new. Of course that's not new. That's gone on for thousands of years. But this extraordinary emotional engagement, the bringing them into the very center of our emotional lives, seeing them as an adjunct member of our family is what's interesting to me and both beautiful and troubling, because in my own lives, you know, I'm crazy about my dogs. But I don't want to see them the same way I see my daughter or the same way I see my wife. And I think if my wife is getting more emotional support from the dog than from me, I need to know about that. I want to do something about that. I'd like to remedy that.
So if I'm sitting around talking with my dog about an existential crisis or the boss at work or a traffic ticket that I got or how I can't pay the bills, what's the downside for the dog?
Well, this is an extraordinary anthropomorphizing of dogs, where you know, which is really accelerated. And the University of Kentucky and a lot of other researchers, the American Veterinary Association has a lot of studies about how much this has accelerated in the past 20 or 25 years. Because one of the other things that's new doesn't involve dogs, but involves society. Our kids move away from us. You know, it's hard for us to meet other people. Americans spend 3 to 6 hours a night watching television. And now you have cable, now you have the internet. So it's literally very difficult for them to connect with people. And these qualities, this disconnection, fragmentation of society, is the other thing that's really new and accelerating that is causing, I think, people to ask more and more of dogs. I think there's an element of truth here that's very, very important. For one thing, I think we need to see the truth about dogs. They're not people. They are animals. They need to be treated like animals. The smartest dog is not as smart as a 3-year-old.
So talking to the dog, but talking to the dog is just a stream of syllables to the dog, right? And
it's a stream of syllables. If you know that, it's fine. You know, I talk to my dogs all the time, but I just understand that they don't understand what I'm saying, and they don't have advice to give back for me. I get enormous emotional support from my dog, but I don't want my dog to be more supportive than humans in my life.
So the practical consequence for the dog is that they're dressed up in a smoking jacket and asked to dinner instead of taken out to run in the woods.
Well, no, they're much worse than that. I mean, only 3 to 5% of dogs in America are trained at all.
What's the connection between training and because emotional dependence on dogs? You're saying an owner who's more emotionally dependent is less likely to train a dog. Why?
Because they see them as being human. They see them as being fragile. They see them as being needy. They find it. They're bringing their own attachment issues and emotional issues into their relationship with the dog.
Not a subspecies to be trained or dominated.
Well, I wouldn't even say a subspecies. I think the recognition that it's an animal, that dogs need to learn how to live in the world. You know, we have so many dogs and so many non-dog owners who don't like the fact that we have so many dogs. You know, 60% of the population doesn't have a dog. And doesn't like the fact that dogs are running all over the place and pooping all over the place and jumping on them and taking over parks. They're not happy with that. And because non-dog owners are a majority, they tend to win when we have all of these civic conflicts. In many states, including New Jersey, where I'm speaking from, there is no longer one legal place in the state where you can take a dog off leash to run anywhere.
Not one.
Now, people sneak around. We have what's called guerrilla operations where you can dog. But you're asking dogs essentially to live their entire lives. It's another thing that's new, and never once run free, which I think is a strange thing to ask a dog. So you have a civic issue as well. There are enormous consequences to dogs. I think that inability of people to perceive and remember, and a lot of people do remember, of course, certainly people who know dogs remember it, that they're relatively simple animals enables you to train them properly and simply. It's really simple to train a dog, but it does take time. It does take patience.
John, let me invite some of these in. We have a lot waiting to come. Kelly's calling from Oconomowoc, Wisconsin. Hi, Kelly. I hope I got that right. You're on the air.
Yeah, it's Oconomowoc.
Okay, great.
Hi, John.
Hey.
I heard your program earlier, and that your next project is working with on a book about women with dogs.
That's right. That's coming up, John Katz.
And I guess I just wanted to volunteer to let you share my experience about my dog and myself in your book.
Here's an on our volunteer
on air audition. Well, you can certainly email it to me unless Tom wants to hear it.
I don't know which email.
Well, let's hear it, Kelly. We'll get a taste. What's your relationship with your dog?
Well, I don't believe in being her mommy or trying to make her a human being. I have taken on the responsibility of giving her the best dog life she could have. I've had her for 12 years, and she's changed my life in remarkable ways.
It sounds like you may be an example of an American emotionally dependent on their dog, Kelly.
Yeah, in some ways, yeah.
Well, I don't know. You know, Tom, my dogs have changed my life. I mean, I write about dogs now. I have different friends. I do sheep herding. You know, I thought I was rescuing him, but I'm really not sure who saved who.
Exactly.
I don't think there's anything wrong with a dog having a huge impact on your life. It sounds like
Kelly.
I'm sorry. It sounds like you have a very clear sense, though, that you're dealing with a dog and not with a person.
Yes.
Which doesn't mean you can't love it to death or have a great time with it. I just think the distinction is important.
Well, let's see, Kelly, if you had to rank your dog among beings most emotionally important to you, where would the dog be? Number one, two, three?
Number one.
Can I ask if you're married?
Yes, you can ask that.
Does your husband know that this dog is number one?
I don't have a husband.
So the dog really is number one. I mean, John Katz, it sounds like the American you're writing about.
To a certain extent, yeah, I do. I think a dog has become the emotional pillar in your life. It's become very, very important to you. Can you imagine life without
the
dog?
I think that has given me a lot of structure.
Structure because the dog has to be fed and walked and all that?
Yeah, and exercised and socialized and trained and all sorts of things. And
Do you wish there were more people in your life?
Do I?
Yeah.
Actually, having my dog has brought more people into my life.
So here's a case where a dog has led you into more greater contact with people.
And has helped me do things that I never would have dared doing before.
And you've trained the dog?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, to me, Tom, it sounds like a pretty healthy relationship with a dog.
Yeah. I mean, you know, and yet, there's the issue of dog being a person's, someone's number one emotional companion. I mean, who would deny that to Kelly? If that's number one, yeah.
Well, that's a good point. Since you raised that, is a good point. Kelly, does that bother you at all that a dog is the most?
It's number one because my dog is dependent on me.
But do you wish that a person had that kind of relationship with you?
That I could be as close to a person?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
You do. You do wish that. Do you think the closeness with the dog prevents you from maybe doing some more work to make that happen?
Well, yeah, I don't spend the energy trying to make that happen because I do have my dog.
There you go.
You know, one of the people I read about in the book, the chapter called The Good Mother, is an interesting woman who had put a child up for adoption and gone back to find her later. Daughter was very angry with her, wouldn't talk to her.
Mm-hmm.
And she basically said, this is another chance for me to be a mother. And the dog was in diapers and lived in a crib. And she had a lot of trouble with it. The dog became very neurotic and peed all over the house and had a lot of trouble. And to her credit, I think she worked through this. She came to see that the dog couldn't be a child and she couldn't be a mother in that way. She learned more about dog. Very painful for her.
Kelly, leave your contact with our producer here. And if John Katz needs more women for women and dogs, he can get in touch with you. Teresa's calling from Arlington, Massachusetts. Hi, Teresa. You're on the air.
Hi, I really enjoy your show. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I've been showing dogs for about 15 years. I've had Goldens for 20 years, Golden Retrievers.
Okay.
And I absolutely can relate to so much of what your guest is saying. And in particular, when I've bred 7 litters in 15 years, and when I have puppy buyers come, one of the things I always stress to them is, this is a dog. It is not a child. please don't make it into a child, and crate train it and take it to puppy kindergarten. And, you know, imagine the dog when it's fully grown and weighs, you know, 60 to 70 pounds and is muddy and jumps on your couch, because so many dogs are given up because people don't train them as puppies.
Teresa, you imagine that if a new owner treats their dog or sees their dog as a child, that they won't successfully train the dog to just do the rudiments of living with humans?
Well, I've seen it firsthand. I mean, it's amazing what people will allow their dogs to do. And I absolutely agree with what he said about all the places that are now closed to people who have dogs, because it's just, it's amazing. And then the excuses that people will make for their dogs. Mm-hmm. Oh, you know, it's because you have food. Oh, it's because he doesn't like three-year-olds with dark hair.
Right.
Oh, it's
or because he was abused. He was abused.
Yeah. I mean, it's, the list is endless. And, you know, that old saying about you can't teach an old dog new tricks, that's not true. You can take, I mean, rescue dogs, they do this all the time. And it's all about teaching a dog in ways that the dog understands, which means you don't treat it like a child.
So, Teresa, you breed dogs, you show dogs.
Yes.
Where do you see the line between the kind of appropriate human emotional relationship with dogs, which we know can be very close and very warm, and the point at which it becomes something kind of, I don't know, over a line?
Well, you know, I think people forget that they're dogs. And you know, I don't know what came first, the chicken or the egg. I don't know if dogs attract a person who has difficulty in human interaction to begin with, or if it comes after the dog. I don't know if I'm making myself clear, but
no,
there's a lot of people I meet who have dogs, both within the dog show world and without, who I think have issues with people to begin with. And they're not real good communicators. They're not real social people to begin with. I mean, you see a lot of people at dog shows with, you know, social issues, shyness and, you know, inability to communicate and brusque and, you know, not, some of them aren't very nice. I mean, I've met wonderful people through dog shows, don't get me wrong, but I do see those personality types. And I think what happens is, I don't know, maybe they're attracted into their, that world in the first place, because dogs don't judge you. They don't look at the way you look or your personality. Or, you know, are you wealthy? Are you poor?
Take the dog out to be judged.
Are you not?
Right. Take the dog out to be judged, but don't be judged yourself. Teresa, that's a professional eyeful you've given us there, and thanks very much for calling in with it. We're talking tonight about the new work of dogs with writer, dog lover, and keen social observer John Katz. His new book is The New Work of Dogs, Tending to Life, Love, and Family. You can get involved in the conversation online. Go to our website, onpointradio.org, and click on Forums. What's your relationship with your dog? Is your dog important to your emotional health? I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight with novelist and journalist John Katz about his new book, The New Work of Dogs, Tending to Life, Love, and Family. He talks about a society emotionally disconnected, dogs leaping into the breach there and maybe becoming too important as an emotional crutch even for Americans today. John Katz, there's some really touching moments in the book and some also very funny moments. You've got a chapter here on the Divorced Dogs Club, one of the dog nodules that you plugged into there in Montclair, New Jersey. I'd love it if you'd read a little bit just from the top there to give us a sense of what that was about.
Sure. This is one of my favorite groups. I met this remarkable group of women who called themselves the Divorced Dogs Club. They had met at a place called Mills Reservation, where dog people go in this town, and all of them were getting divorced or coming through it, and were using a dog to help them get through it. And they invited me into their meetings, which is sometimes a little bit uncomfortable, but we had quite a great time, and I want to read from it now.
Great.
On a rainy Friday evening, a mud-soaked group of five women and their dogs trooped from Mills Reservation into Rachel Goldner's house for the not-quite-weekly meeting of the Divorced Dogs Club. Soon the women were lounging around the living room with cups of tea or glasses or Merlot, dogs dozing in various corners and cracking themselves up by concocting a list. all of the qualities that made their dogs helpful, loyal, supportive, and otherwise unlike certain other species one might mention. "They don't give a damn what you wear," said Rachel, leading off. "They see you at your worst and love you just the same," piped up Carolyn. "You don't have to convince them that you understand them," Sally added. "You don't have to make time for them. They appreciate the time they get." "Chester always wants to rent the same video I want to rent," was Janice's offering. She meant her black lab. That was not true of Gerald. She meant her ex-husband. "They don't lie," Rachel said. "And they don't fall in love with other people," added Cynthia, jumping in out of turn. "And they are not insecure about their masculinity." There were, it turned out, many advantages to living with dogs. They went to the bathroom quickly and outside. They were happy to spend holidays with the women's trying relatives. They didn't leave dirty clothes and smelly shoes lying around. They didn't stare at televised football games on beautiful fall afternoon. "They have no agendas," Sally said. "Except feed me and love me," said Janice. "And they don't want to have sex with you at strange times," Cynthia blurted out as the rest of the group shrieked. "Well, that's probably a good thing." Rachel was laughing so hard she had to set down her wine glass. "Or maybe not," said Cynthia, to even more howls. Carolyn raised her hand, then laughed at herself for acting as if she were in high school. "Amen to that. But I wouldn't forget something else. Talk about empowerment all you want, but sometimes being a woman alone is a bit scary. And these guys, well, they protect us. I think this guy," she reached down to scratch her Dalmatian, Sharpton, behind the ears, and he wagged his tail and licked her hand. "He would do anything for me. I might be kidding myself, but I think he would." "And aren't we forgetting one of the biggest things of all?" asked Janice, causing the group to quiet down and listen. "They don't leave."
John Katz reading from his new book, The New Work of Dogs, about the Divorced Dogs Club. John, we have a lot of people who want to join us. Let's invite them in. Anthony's calling from Greenville, North Carolina. Hi, Anthony. You're on the air.
Hey, how you doing?
Great, thanks.
Hey, Anthony.
Basically, I'm just calling. I've been listening to you on the radio, and I'd like to share my relationship with my dog. I'm a graduate student
at
East Carolina University, and I have actually a rare breed. I have a pit bull, and now she is they are very known for fighting and whatnot. But I've raised her as actually what has been said before as a daughter. She really is a child to me, and I take a lot of responsibility in raising her, and basically she's a very, very large part of my life.
Dr. Katz, the dog owner is in. What's your question for grad student?
I think the key word that I heard there, and I think Teresa would have liked hearing it too, is Anthony's use of the word responsibility. I make a big deal in the book of the need for people who own dogs to take emotional responsibility for them. We all know that pit bulls are inherently quite sweet and loving dogs. My dog's best friend is a pit bull, happens to be Daphne, Minnie. But they have to be trained. They have to be socialized. People have to take responsibility for them, because if you don't have a dog and you don't know dogs, you're walking down the street with your kid, you have no way of knowing whether Anthony is responsible or not.
But, John, at the same time, Anthony is stepping up in line with Kelly earlier and saying, this dog is like my child.
Well, I think if you take responsibility, it's an individual choice of how you want to use the dog. I mean, I don't know what else is going on in Anthony's life. I think everybody has the right to have a dog the way they want to have a dog. I'm not meaning to lecture the world on how to do it. Mm-hmm. But responsibility is really very key. Responsibility to me means seeing the dog as a dog and not as a child. It means training the dog and being responsible for it. I'm sure if Anthony is a responsible owner of a pit bull, he's done some pretty good training. Would that be right?
Yes.
Anthony, let me ask you the same question I asked Kelly earlier. Where does your dog rank in your life in terms of emotional importance? 1, 2, 3, 10?
I would have to say 2. I have a lot of other things I have to think about, but, I mean, she is definitely – she's very high up on my rank. She's very important to me. Actually, I was listening to you before. I talk to her every day, not just once a month.
About the big issues in your life?
No, not about the big issues in my life. I just actually just talked to her to try to – basically, she's at the point to right now she can sit down in front of me, and I can talk to her for 5 minutes. As long as I keep a certain tone in my voice, her head will go back and forth, back and forth.
Sure, she'll love
very
it.
Very coherent. She listens, and that's why I do it, because I think it makes her feel better.
Absolutely. Good for you.
By the way, that's a very important training device, what Anthony is doing, consciously or not. – When the dog makes that kind of eye contact and pays that kind of attention, that means that the dog is very trainable. You know, Tom, I developed a theory in the book, apart from the University of Kentucky, about what I call the balance point. And I say, well, you know, love your dog as much as you want. It's not for me to tell you that. But I found what I saw was that a lot of this depended on the number of things, elements people had in a life. If you have friends, family, work, hobbies, and a dog, you love the dog all you want, it's fine. As you remove these other things from somebody's life and you end up with only the dog, I think that's where people can sometimes get into difficulty.
Yep, all about balance.
Because the dog assumes such enormous importance.
John, I want to get one more call. Rue is calling from Arlington, Massachusetts. Hi, Rue. Make it quick. You're on the air.
Hi there. Hi. I'm a dog trainer.
Yeah.
And I actually get fairly regular referrals from a few therapists.
Like psychotherapists?
Yes.
And why would they? Who are they referring dogs to or humans?
Well, actually, it turns out to be both. I mean, I say I'm a dog trainer, but really I'm training the people to train their dogs and giving them insight into what's going on with their animals.
Why does the therapist send his client to you, a dog trainer?
Because the dogs can develop all sorts of issues because of the stress that's going on in the household. So if there is, emotional upheaval or strife or whatever going on in the household, frequently the dog starts showing behavior problems as well, which can, it can be urinating on the bed when a new partner comes into the life of the owner.
So the dog is so sewn into the emotional life of a family that the therapist who's seeing the human client sends that client to you to figure out how to deal with it. Rue, we're almost out of time. I've got to let you go with that, but thanks for calling. John Katz, there's the dog, almost on the therapist's couch.
Well, I think, the great thing people can do for their dogs is to understand the issues that they're bringing to the relationship. You know, I think the more self-awareness people have about their own psychology, the better the training is going to go and the happier the dog is going to be. So I certainly have no problem with that. Sounds like a smart therapist.
John Katz, it's been great having you. And I wonder about your dogs there in the studio, Orson and Homer. They've been awfully quiet this hour.
They have been sound asleep. I have to say, as they usually do when I talk about dogs, they just go to sleep.
they know enough about that.
Yeah, they've heard it. They've heard that before.
John Katz,
great call.
It's been great to have you. We'll look for that next book on women and dogs. It sounds like from your Divorced Dogs Club, you've got a pretty good start there. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. It's a great pleasure.
John Katz, new book is The New Work of Dogs, Tending to Life, Love, and Family. We're going to end this hour with reflections from Pulitzer Prize-winning Washington Post columnist Charles Krauthammer. Though he didn't grow up a dog person, Krauthammer says his love affair with a black lab named Chester has helped him understand the inexorable bond between canines and humans.
The way I see it, dogs had this big meeting, maybe 20,000 years ago. A huge meeting, an international convention with delegates from everywhere. And that's when they decided that humans were the up-and-coming species and dogs were going to throw in their lot with them. The decision was obviously not unanimous. The wolves and dingoes walked out in protest. Cats had an even more negative reaction. When they heard the news, they called their own meeting, in Paris, of course, to denounce canine subservience to the human hyperpower. Their manifesto, La Condition Féline, can still be found in provincial bookstores. Cats, it must be said, have not done too badly. Using guile and seduction, they managed to get humans to feed them, thus preserving their superciliousness without going hungry, a neat trick. Dogs, being guileless, signed and delivered. It was the beginning of a beautiful friendship. I must admit that I've been slow to warm to dogs. I grew up in a non-pet-friendly home. Dogs do not figure prominently in Jewish immigrant households. My father was not very high on pets. Now, he wasn't hostile. He just saw them as superfluous and encumbrance. When the Cossacks are chasing you around Europe, you need to travel light. This, by the way, is why Europe produced far more Jewish violinists than pianists. Try packing a piano. My parents did allow a hint of zoological indulgence. I had a pet turtle. My brother had a parakeet. Both came to unfortunate ends. My turtle fell behind a radiator and was not discovered until too late. And the parakeet, God bless him, flew out a window once, never to be seen again. After such displays of stewardship, we dared not ask for a dog. My introduction to the wonder of dogs came from my wife, Robin. She's Australian. and Australia, as lovingly recounted in Bill Bryson's In a Sunburned Country, has the craziest, wildest, deadliest, meanest animals on the planet. In a place where every spider and squid can take you down faster than a sucker punch boxer, you cherish niceness in the animal kingdom, and they don't come nicer than dogs. Robin started us off slowly. She got us a border collie, Hugo, when our son was about 6. She knew that would appeal to me because the border collie is the smartest species on the planet. Hugo could play outfield in our backyard baseball games, do flawless front door sentry duty, and play psychic weatherman, announcing with a wail every coming thunderstorm. When our son Daniel turned 10, he wanted a dog of his own. I was against it, using arguments borrowed from seminars on nuclear nonproliferation. It was hopeless. One giant, please, Dad, and I caved completely. Robin went out to Winchester, Virginia, found a litter of black labs, and brought home Chester. Chester is what psychiatrists mean when they talk about unconditional love. Unbridled is more like it. Come into our house, and he was so happy to see you, he'd knock you over. Deliverymen learn to leave things at the front door. In some respects, PhD potential, for example, I don't make any great claims for Chester. When I would arrive home, I fully expected to find Hugo reading the newspaper, not Chester. Chester would try to make his way through a narrow sliding door, find himself stuck halfway, and then look at me with total and quite genuine puzzlement. I don't think he ever got to understand that the rear part of him was actually attached to the front. But it was Chester who dispensed affection as unreflectively as he breathed, who got me thinking about this long-ago pact between humans and dogs. Cat lovers and the petiverse will just roll their eyes at such dogophilia. I can't help it. Chester was always at your foot or your hand, waiting to be petted and stroked, played with and talked to. His beautiful blocky head, his wonderful overgrown puppy's body, his baritone bark filled every corner of home and heart. Then last month, at the tender age of 8, he died quite suddenly. The long, slobbering, slothful decline we'd been looking forward to was not to be. When told the news, a young friend who was a regular victim of Chester's lunging love bombs said mournfully, "He was the sweetest creature I ever saw. He's the only dog I ever saw kiss a cat." Some will protest that in a world with so much human suffering, it is something between eccentric and obscene to mourn a dog. I think not. After all, it is perfectly normal, indeed deeply human, to be moved when nature presents us with a vision of great beauty. Should we not be moved when it produces a vision, a creature, of the purest sweetness?
Charles Krauthammer is a Pulitzer Prize-winning columnist with The Washington Post. His essay on Chester is from Time magazine. On Point is produced by Meghna Chakrabarty, Alina Mata, Virginia Prescott, John Roberts, James Ross, Keith Shields, Karen Schiffman, and Tim Skog, with help from Chris O'Connor. Our senior producer is Graham Griffith. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.